This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Stephen Zunis. Stephen, welcome to KABU again.
Good to be back.
Stephen Zunis writes, agitates, he teaches, he does scholarly work and op-ed pieces for Popular and Left Press. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, coordinates the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's an editor at the journal Peace Review. He particularly knows the virtues of and many methods of nonviolent protest, building powerful nonviolent movements, nonviolent but still forceful. We talked last week about the U.S. attack on Iran and its possible consequences, that in fact this attack is spurring Iranian nationalism and support for the regime and actually helping the hardline forces in Iran. We talked about how Iran is a very complex society with all sorts of voices, to be sure. Let's now talk about why the U.S. is so hostile to Iran.
Well, I think, as I mentioned last week, there are many legitimate criticisms about the Iranian regime in both its domestic and foreign policy, though certainly their U.S. allies, you know, such as Saudi Arabia, that have even worse records in these areas. So that's not the reason. The idea that Iran is an aggressor nation that is ready to invade its neighbors or anything like that's ludicrous. Iran hasn't engaged in a war of aggression for over 2.5 centuries. I think really what it comes down to is that the United States just doesn't like the fact that Iran is a regional power that does not give in to American hegemony. If you look back to the 2002 National Security Statement, the United States made very clear that not only would we resist the rise of a rival superpower such as China, we would challenge any kind of regional power that would threaten U.S. hegemony. It was what was known as full spectrum dominance. The problem is that Iran has been a regional power on and off for over 2,500 years, and they resent being treated like some kind of banana republic that the United States can pressure. They're not going to compromise with a gun at their head. So I think that really their big crime in the eyes of the United States is that it is not willing to follow its dictates in that part of the world. And, therefore, there's this attitude that they are therefore a threat. They're not a threat to us in terms of our national security, but they are a threat to U.S. hegemony.
Yeah, and they're a threat to U.S. hegemony as it operates to privilege U.S. oil companies and the rest of the capitalist apparatus, our parts of the capitalist apparatus. We sort of won the great war of the 20th century, that is the control of Middle Eastern oil after World War II. The U.S. took over the Middle East and the control of oil. Iran really does threaten that because, in fact, Iran is that regional power that, in fact, has allies in the Middle East. That is the despicable regime in Syria, but also Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's the only, and then the military that was so capable, it forced Israel out of southern Lebanon when they were trying to sort of take it over in the same way they took over the Golan Heights in Syria. So it seems to me that there really is a threat to U.S. economic interests posed by the Iranians. And the Iranians, of course, have to support all these other movements to protect themselves, because if the whole Middle East turns against them, it seems to me it's extremely troublesome for them and they get weakened. They really are a threat, but they're a threat that we should support, not so much the Iranian state, but the Middle Eastern countries' control of their own resources. That's essential, in fact, to democratizing those countries before climate change, of course, wipes them all out.
Iran, like Saudi Arabia and Israel, that are also regional powers, have certainly supported elements, including certain paramilitary groups that counter governments and movements that they oppose. And in the end, some of these groups are pretty nasty. Some of them have popular support and some less so. Hezbollah is an interesting example in that Hezbollah is a popular movement that represents the country's Shia Muslim population, which is the largest of the various ethno-sectarian groups in Lebanon, but of the three major ones, it's traditionally had the least power. It's traditionally the poorest of the three as well. And they had this, and Hezbollah is a which grew out of the 22 year Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, is a pretty reactionary group. I'm no big fan of theirs, but they do have a lot of popular support, and Iranian support has been very critical and important to them at times. Though, actually, despite Iran giving them some financial support, they actually get most of their money from contributions from the Shia population, from taxation, because people there get a lot more from them in terms of social services than they do from the central Lebanese government. You mentioned Iraq, and of course the overthrow of Saddam, who was a bulwark against the Iranians, led to the election of the sectarian Shia parties, which have come to dominate the Iraqi governments in most of the years since the U.S. invasion and occupation. And these have been very formidable fighting forces. They've worked with the United States in fighting ISIS. They have been they've been accused of some war crimes in the process. Not nearly as much as ISIS, of course, but they've been ruthless at times. But they've worked with the U.S. essentially on the same side of fighting ISIS. But they play a role in Iraqi politics, again thanks to the U.S. invasion. Another allied group are the Houthis, which is a Zayedi group based in northern Yemen that succeeded in taking over much of the country when the U.S. undermined the pro-democracy movement there and installed a general who had been the dictator's vice president, and things fell apart. But the reason I'm mentioning all these things is that the mainstream media, along with the Trump administration, keeps referring to these groups as Iranian proxies. And that's a dangerous word, because proxy implies that they take orders directly from Tehran. And there's a difference between proxies and allies. And the reason that word, that distinction is important, is that let's say you Saudi Arabia bombs yet another Yemeni village in Houthi-controlled territory, and a local Houthi commander retaliates by lobbing a rocket into a Saudi airbase across the border. And let's say the Saudi airbase, like most Saudi airbases, has U.S. personnel there. And let's say this this rocket ends up killing an American serviceman. You know darn well the Trump administration will say, Iran has attacked the United States, because the Houthis are supposedly proxies, and proxies do what they're ordered to do, even though in this case it would be just this individual Houthi commander. And that's what's dangerous about this kind of oversimplification, that we see these complex civil wars going on of various competing factions. And yes, you'll have Iran and Saudi Arabia and the United States and Qatar and sometimes Israel supporting various factions for their own benefit, but it's not like these groups wouldn't exist otherwise. I mean, these are local conflicts with local issues, some going back generations. But by oversimplifying it as, us versus Iran, is really a formula that could get us into a war.
Yeah, and issues that are not just power issues, they're class issues. Most of the groups that are allied with Iran were the poorest and dominated by various elites, usually Sunni elites dominating a Shiite majority, like in Iraq, having a military supported by the U.S. and cooperating fully with U.S. oil companies. It seems to me these are also semi-class struggles in every one of these countries. And it seems to me sort of class struggles where you got to side with the underdogs.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing that any of the regimes are particular models of democracy and decency, but in fact, they are more promising than the regimes, the kleptocratic and often some monarchies that are repressing them. Anyway, at least that's my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. But the problem really is that there are popular class-based movements for justice, that they are often eclipsed because of all the guns. I mean, in Egypt, there have been scores of strikes that have involved many hundreds of thousands of Egyptians struggling for economic justice. But we don't hear about that in this country. We hear about some tiny armed Islamist group in the Sinai, or some other Islamic extremist group, and we miss the fact that most people in the Middle East are struggling for the same things that workers and other oppressed classes are struggling for elsewhere. I mean, one thing really striking about my time in Iran is I talked to an Iranian trade union activist who's been in and out of jail due to the repression of the regime. And he was pointing out how, you know, with the lifting of sanctions and the economy improving, and yet it not trickling down to the masses and the working class, it was empowering trade union activists to start challenging the regime's policies. Because the Iranian regime, like the U.S. government and a number of other places, you know, have used nationalism and conservative religious ideals to get working class support, even though their economic policies are against the interest of working people. But this guy is telling me about, hey, we're getting some momentum here, but by renewing the sanctions, the regime can blame all the economic problems on the sanctions and not on their misguided economic policies. And the threat of war has gotten people to rally around the flag, and it's made it easier for the regime to say that any kind of dissident group, including those who are working for labor rights, are therefore an American imperialist agent. And so, you know, U.S. policy is going a long way in hurting working class solidarity and hopes for social justice and democracy. I'd say not just in Iran, but in elsewhere in that part of the world as well.
Right. Yeah, although one thing about Iran is even though they imprison labor leaders, they rarely kill them, and that's really a difference. The Iranian, also the oil workers union, from time to time has been able even to strike and to make demands, and most of them are still alive. In Saudi Arabia, they're not allowed, and those people are just dispatched, right? That dissidence is just not even imaginable there in some of the other countries. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Stephen Zunis. We've been discussing the current struggle in the Middle East, the one that's most pressing and could lead to a general Middle Eastern war, or the annihilation of millions of people. It's not inconceivable. They're sort of on that path. And there are some who really do want to obliterate Iran, parts of the U.S. Trump administration. In fact, we haven't talked about that, Steve. I think another reason that the U.S.'s elites and parts of the U.S. elites, but they're important and influential in foreign policy, have been humiliated by their defeats in the Middle East for the last 20 years since the attack on Iraq, that is the liberation movement that the U.S. sponsored in Iraq, to depose Saddam Hussein and set up a free market paradise. It turned out, of course, that the new Iraqi regime that was elected has sort of worked with Iran and supports Iran. They're both Shiite states, and Iran did help them, at least militarily, in terms of strategies. It seems to me that those elites, though, like John Bolton, really have deep in their hearts a hatred of Iran because Iran basically humiliated them in the terms of their foreign policy choices. First, supporting Saddam Hussein and giving him poison gas capacities in the Iran-Iraq War, which the Iranians still remember, vast numbers of deaths. But secondly, in the attack on the U.S. operations in, well, all sorts of them against Iran. It seems to me part of the reason that the U.S. continues this sort of drumbeat and attack on Iran and their obsession with Iran is that these guys want revenge. They've been seen as, I mean, under Trump, of course, they've made a comeback, but they've been seen as, within elite foreign policy circles as fools, as sort of bullies who are trying to sort of force other countries to accept their power and their ideas of governance, and in fact, miserably failed. That is, they were really miserable failures in terms of policy. Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and George Bush and John Bolton, who has power in the Trump regime, and Elliot Abrams, that whole crew of them, it seems to me, are really seen as fools, or can be described that way, and sometimes are in actually elite circles. They're itching to do something about Iran. It seems to me it's really that's an obsession for those guys. Yeah, is that wrong?
The fact that Iran has resisted so many U.S. Efforts to destroy the regime or otherwise compromise them, they're frustrated. We don't live like the world was in the 1950s when the United States could actually come up and, working with a few disgruntled elites, stage a coup and put in a government more to our own liking. And there's an incredible amount of frustration there, and they indeed want their revenge. The one thing that gives me a little bit of hope is I don't think Donald Trump is really one of them. A lot of people forget that he actually, you know how Trump is obsessed with his base, and strengthening the base, which is why he's really pushing all these really awful, racist and anti-immigrant and homophobic and anti-abortion kind of positions. But he also knows that it was the fact that he actually ran to the left of Hillary Clinton on foreign policy, that he disingenuously said that he opposed the Iraq war, while Clinton, of course, was a major supporter of it. And indeed, if you look at the counties that shifted most dramatically from Obama in 2008-2012 to Trump in 2016, they parallel almost exactly the counties with the largest casualty rates from the Iraq war. So Trump, came into these places and saying, I will not send your sons and daughters overseas, America first. He fed into this growing isolationist sentiments you're seeing among white working class voters. And these kind of people hate the neocons, And so he knows that he does get us into a war in Iran. It's not going to be popular, and it really is going to hurt his base, who will feel betrayed by this. Now, this doesn't mean that there isn't a risk for war when we're on a hair trigger type situation as we are now. The risk of a war starting is still very, very real. We still really need to mobilize on that. But I think that Trump himself is shares a degree of skepticism of the neoconservatives and their agenda. He just naively thinks he can bully the Iranians into compromise by making threats. And I don't think he necessarily wants to follow through with them. But again, it's a very, very high stakes game, and the risk of war is still very real.
That also raises a problem. Yes, he doesn't want to become unpopular by killing a lot of America's unemployed young men from the Rust Belt, as his predecessors were perfectly ready to do. But he's going to take the Obama route, which is drones and air power. You don't lose many people in Nevada. You lose a few drones every now and then. It's only $500 million. What's the difference in our military budget?
Iran's going to be very different. This is not going to be just sending in some drones to take out some installations. It's going to require taking out command and control and anti-aircraft and other installations, and very likely at least some special forces on the ground, at least for short-term periods. The fact is that people in the Pentagon do these war games. They see every scenario looks very, very bad for the United States and its interests. And the big hope I have right here is that there are a lot of people in the Pentagon right now, generals, admirals, others, who are telling the president, we've run these war games. We see what's going to happen. This is not going to be good. Don't do it.
Steve, what's to be done by a peace movement in the United States?
Basically, I think we need to continue pressuring. I would like to see something like the Pledge of Resistance that we had on Central America, where tens of thousands of Americans pledged to do massive civil obedience if the U.S. actually invaded, to have some training for massive direct action that can serve as something of a deterrent. I think another thing is this greater education. We're blessed by having a large Iranian-American community, one which is actually highly educated and politically involved. I mean, it's diverse, and you do have a few of your Ahmad Shalabi wannabes and unrepentant monarchists and others, but most of them are like most Iranians. They don't like the regime, but they don't like U.S. policy either. They don't want war. And I think we can learn a lot from them, and we need to have them at our rallies and our teach-ins and whatever. Sharing their perspectives and learning from them. But I think it's really important to mobilize the forces of the American peace movement, and be sure to make it as diverse as possible in terms of class, race, ethnicity, etc. And I'm already seeing the beginnings of that, but we certainly need to do a lot more.
Steve Zunis, thanks a lot for talking to us. It's very informative. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You as well.
So long.